And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
We'll get started right about now. Hey, everybody. Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. This is Phil Lairness. And down under, this is Mujahideen.
Hilarious what you just did. Hi, everyone.
It's a callback for us to a couple weeks ago, simpler times, when...
Our favorite war movies.
Well, we were talking about our favorite war movies. Yeah, well, I was looking at my cat going, should I be worried about her? And you were saying that cat looks worried about you, quite frankly, because I was so sick. We'll talk about that. Yeah. But yes, war movies. War movies we were talking about. What a fun show we actually have lined up. I mean, we get to talk about the return, if I may, of three legendary brands. We've got The X-Files, Season 11. Not only the return of that brand, but literally the return in the sense that most people would agree that Season 10 did not live up to the legacy of the show that was created.
Right.
But as every review of... episode 2 of season 11 entitled This, which of course also showcased the return of legendary brand Dean Haglund as Richard Ringo Langley. This episode, This, as every review I read proclaimed in its headlines, this is more like it. And so it's safe to say on the basis of that episode that truly The X-Files is back. And so we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about what it means that the X-Files seems to have certainly carved out some terrain worth exploring, worthy of its illustrious past, in the same week that Gillian Anderson confirms that this will be it for her. So quite an interesting juxtaposition. We get to talk about the return of Star Trek Discovery. The back half of its first season has premiered with some real, if you'll pardon the Star Trek pun, course corrections evident in what they are doing. And David Letterman, is he a brand? Yeah, I think he's a brand. Yeah. After 33 years as a late night host, he has returned to talk show hosting with a Netflix show called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. So we will get to talk about all those things. But first... we would be remiss if we did not revisit our top 10 war films episode, which dropped last week because people seemed to really enjoy it, and not only really enjoy it, but really wanted to engage with us on a variety of topics.
Well, that's what we like. That's what we mean.
Well, absolutely. We love hearing from people, and that's one of the things we mean when we say this is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Exactly.
People were amazed, Dean, and maybe we were too in putting our lists together, but they were really amazed by how many different kinds of films were represented. It's easy to say, is it not, oh, I don't like war films. And to have a...
right.
I mean, look, I'm shocked that people will say, oh, I don't like science fiction. And I'll say, what about this? What about this? What about this? And they'll go, well, those aren't science fiction. I'll go, what do you mean they're not science fiction?
Well, there's no
spaceships in it. Like, it's so easy to identify a genre by the thing you don't like that you forget how elastic the storytelling can be within these genres. And so our lists had action films, had drama films, had suspense films, had comedy, had romance, had biopics. So something for everyone, I think. And again, people were really seemed to be amazed. It opened it opened some eyes.
Well, good. That's what we like. You know, we spend all our time watching these obscure movies. Why not share it with the rest of everyone?
Of course, a week can't go by of me doing a podcast without my friend Maurice Terenzio, loyal listener, reaching out with a correction of something I said. So let's begin there.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Hey, Maurice. Hey, Phil. I'm giving you a whole lot of slack because your entire household has been under the weather. For that reason, I am not coming down on you for saying that Robert Altman scored big time for writing the theme from MASH, Suicide is Painless. Robert Altman did not write it. His son, Mike Altman, wrote the lyrics to the song, and by doing so, Mike scored big time and was paid much more than his father received for directing the film.
I didn't know that.
Of course, this put Mike in a position to offer his father a spot loan at a competitive rate, so Robert may have done well in that respect. But this is only speculation and has yet to be verified. Maurice, I am so glad that he brought this up. I kind of knew that I was getting it wrong when I said it, but worried about my cat, still recovering from my own bout of lung illness. I honestly kind of didn't care that I was getting it wrong in the moment, but I'm glad that the real story has been shared, and it gives me an opportunity to share one of my favorite memories ever. Do you remember a store? I think they still exist, but it's been literally, I have not been into one this century. Nordstrom's. Do you remember Nordstrom's?
Yeah. They're still around.
Okay. So I can't speak to whether they still have this, but every store had at least one grand piano and a tuxedo-clad piano player playing live for you to accompany your shopping or your returns or your browsing, whatever it was.
Browsing, right.
Do you remember this? Yeah. Does that ring a bell?
Sort of. Like, I don't know if I associate it specifically with Nordstrom. I've seen shopping malls with a piano player in it and department stores with some guy playing piano. Now, was that unique to that brand? I don't know. But let's say it was.
It was always very recognizable to me about Nordstrom's because it was one store where you could count on not having piped in music. So you would hear live piano playing. And anyway, I remember one time I was going up the escalator there at the West Side Pavilion in Nordstrom's, and as soon as I reached the top, the piano player starts playing the theme from MASH. And I start laughing uncontrollably, and he looks at me, and he's very shaken as I'm staring at him laughing. And he stops, and he said, "Is there something wrong?" I said, "Do you know what the name of that song is?" And he said, "MASH." I said, "No, there's lyrics to that song." And he said, "There is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's Suicide is Painless." And then I point out, which actually makes this probably the most appropriate song you could play in this store. By all means, continue. I loved it. It was such a thing where it was the perfect, you know, marriage of song to corporate American lifestyle.
See? Sometimes we make the mistakes for the right reason.
Yes, I would use that actually in a movie if more people knew that there were lyrics to the song. But again, most people just think Alan Alda. And why wouldn't they? Alan Alda's a national treasure. Yeah. Okay. Right. Cindy Shockey wrote to us, "My favorite war movie isn't a serious one. Kelly's Heroes. Everything about it just clicks."
Yeah, totally. That was on my list.
Made it on your list. Absolutely.
And I can't remember if you saw it or not.
Oh, yeah, of course I have. You know, I am, and as I get older, I am all the more so, a real Clint Eastwood aficionado. Just the arc of that man's career and how he evolved as an actor and a storyteller and as a director, I find incredibly inspiring and instructive and informative. So, of course, I went back and made sure probably about 10 years ago, I saw When Eagles Dare and Kelly's Heroes in a double feature. And it was great fun. His chemistry, you wouldn't think necessarily, or maybe you would, but his chemistry with Richard Burton in Where Eagles Dare was so good. Such different actors, and yet their chemistry was so good together.
So surprising. You wouldn't think that was a matchup that would work.
Patrick Sullivan wrote us, said, thank you for mentioning Great Escape and Dirty Dozen as sort of companion pieces. I have always felt the same. Side note, I always watch Dirty Dozen on Christmas. It seems to perfectly mirror a family dynamic around the holidays.
Wow. Wow. I guess. I mean, all the Nazis are at a party, and somebody's coming in to try to screw that up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I could see that being a Christmas favorite.
Linda Van Manen, our dear friend Linda in the Netherlands, who lived very near where a legendary war film, A Bridge Too Far, which may have been, when we were talking about A Bridge Too Far on one show, that might have been what inspired our whole idea of doing a top 10 war films. I think we realized
moment. Right?
Yeah, we never talked about it. She lives very near where a lot of that was filmed. But she had a correction about a film on your list. A German film set in a submarine directed by Wolfgang Petersen. What was that film, Dean?
That's called Das Boot. And I can't imagine what I got screwed up on that one.
It's pronounced as boat. Sorry, had to tell, LOL.
Oh.
It's Das in German. It's pronounced Das Boot, even though spelled double O. Okay, but here's where I want to say both thank you, Linda. Also, not so fast. Far be it from me to defend Dean Haglund in a pronunciation, but yes, the German pronunciation is closer to boat. It's, you know, it's Das Boot. But we aren't in Germany. We also aren't in a German-speaking country. And you might say, well, if the origin of a word is from a certain language, then that language's pronunciation ought to hold sway. And ordinarily, I might agree with you because to change it is a certain form of cultural imperialism that is distasteful. That said, I have to acknowledge that this very podcast originates from a fair city that is not pronounced Los Angeles.
That's true.
It's pronounced Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
Right.
Not Los Angeles.
Nor is my neighborhood pronounced Los Feliz. It's Los Feliz. There is a town near where my parents live, actually, that was founded as a camp of railroad workers from the subcontinent of India. And the town was therefore called Delhi. How is it pronounced, however? Delhi, because they don't want to be thought of as a camp of Indian railroad workers. So Das Boot. Unfortunately, I can't find an English language trailer where the title gets named. I believe, Dean, that we are basing our pronunciation, Das Boot, on probably the movie review shows of the age where we heard the film mentioned. So they might have indeed gotten it wrong and passed it down to us. I have no way of knowing, but I did want to point that out, that in America especially, we are quick to change the pronunciation of foreign words that we appropriate for our own language.
Yeah, that's kind of a thing, isn't it?
So we've alluded to the fact that when we last recorded, I was worried about my cat, my beloved cat, Fuzz Aldrin. Thought it was very clear that she was worried about me. We probably were both right. She laid by my side, standing constant vigil during the week or so that I was bedridden with whatever had affected. I'm calling it the Southern California fire flu that everybody came down with. But she does get very worried when I'm sick. And on Christmas Day, she stopped eating. And the morning after I saw you to record those shows, you know, I had to take her into emergency care. Her breathing, once she got there, was quite troubled. She was diagnosed with congestive heart failure and given three months to a year to live. The next day, they were going to release her with a full, treatment plan for me to follow. But there was one reading that she had, a low blood pressure reading that was not consistent with congestive heart failure. So the doctor at that emergency hospital found a cardiologist on duty at an emergency hospital in Culver City, at an animal hospital. And that cardiologist said, yes, I'd be happy to perform the test, but we're booked up for appointments for several days. If he brings the cat in through emergency care, then it's automatically a test that we would do. So I had to check Fuzz in to another emergency facility, thinking that we were getting this test done and then she would come home with me. And indeed, she stayed in this second facility for 2 weeks. Because one of the first things that they found was, no, it was not congestive heart failure. The atriums are fine. The ventricles, the atriums, what am I?
The heart chambers.
The heart chambers, exactly. You know about this. And so to this day, we're not sure. It was a process of aggressively treating everything that might have been infecting her lungs and her abdomen. They eliminated the big things, which I think were mostly helpful for them to relax. And she started to heal better when the doctors around her were relaxed, but eliminated cancer, eliminated, alien abduction. They did a test for that. Every expensive test imaginable, they did. And it was bad. I mean, our girl at the very least had pneumonia. She had asthma. She might have toxoplasmosis, an illness that was dormant for 5 years because she hasn't been in contact with any other cats since we got her. But the point is, a very, very sick little kitty. And, she is small, and she's small because of her rather traumatic origin story. She was found in a box on the Vegas Strip, the only survivor of a box of newborn kittens that were laid out for adoption, as you would do in 120 degree weather on the Vegas Strip. And a woman was in the process of disposing of a box of dead kittens when she saw some motion. One of the kittens had survived by apparently sucking moisture out of the box. That was our Fuzz Aldrin. She was so emaciated, so tiny, so withered from this birth and entry into the world that they literally could not identify gender at first. And that's why Fuzz was given the name Fuzz Aldrin, a name that embodied the bravery and spirit of exploration that they hoped this little cat might aspire to achieve. And so as a result of being named Fuzz Aldrin, many, many people make the mistake and refer to our girl as he. And it used to bother me because she's so pretty. How could she not be a girl? But I must realize now that Buzz Aldrin himself must be mistaken sometimes as a girl because they're thinking of our cat, Fuzz Aldrin. Such is her fame. Right? It's like how Ray Bradbury, when I worked for him at UCLA, was mistaken for Gene Roddenberry. Somebody came up to him and said, thank you for Star Trek. And he was so cool about it. And, and I said, that's really graceful that you don't correct him. And he said, well, I figure by now, Gene must have been mistaken for me at some time. And if these people love things, it makes them feel good to be able to thank the person who created these things. So why take that away from them? Of course, I then pointed out to him, what happens when they get home and somebody tells them Gene Roddenberry's been dead for a couple years, and then the whole thing becomes a Ray Bradbury story. But anyway, so that's the ballad of Fuzz Aldrin. And sure, this little girl, very, very sick. And,
on the mend.
On the mend now. I mean, we got to that dark place where the third path was discussed. of what's the best way to put the cat down. And I always say the best way to put the cat down is tell her that she's short and she dresses funny and she's a terrible burden on her parents. But but we had that. We had that discussion of where do we want it to happen, how do we want it to happen, if it has to happen. But I got to tell you, every single day in some way, this cat let us know that she wanted to live if we were willing to buy her, literally buy her the time she needed to get well, because she needed to be on oxygen. She needed to be on a feeding tube. She needed to be on an IV. You know, we couldn't provide these things. And so it literally was, you know, $1,300 a day plus all the experiments or tests.
experiments.
And you know, veterinary medicine, I don't know what it was like for you in, and I want to talk about your dogs a little bit. I don't know what it was like in Australia. But here, veterinary care is different than human health care. And we don't talk about how animal health care reform is needed, but it is. And here, if a person shows up, even if they're told not to, facilities won't deny treatment. After all, they've taken a Hippocratic oath. First of all, you should do no harm. And refusing treatment is to do harm. So you're given a bill when you get out, and then you hopefully are able to pay off that bill. When it comes to animals, you pay daily, like a hotel, or you're kicked out. And so I got
that's common.
Is that how it? I mean, does that work? Is that common in other countries, not just America?
That's right. There is no government health care for animals. But there's insurance and
news
is always
news we could have used.
There's pet insurance. Now, some of that's pricey when you think, oh, gee whiz, $500 a year or whatever. And, you know, for some breeds like the Dobermans, they don't cover the very thing that Akasha had, which is the heart failure, because some animals like Doberman Pinschers have a genetic predisposition to heart disease. So if you want to have insurance for what they are 45% chance of getting, then you can get it, but your premiums are through the roof, right? So, but so many other diseases, like Mila had the kidney failure. Had we had medical insurance for her, that would have been covered for all the treatments and the pills. So as everyone says, well, pet insurance, I don't need it until you actually need it. And then it comes through. Many people I know have paid for pet insurance and the pets lived a long, happy life and then died of natural causes 14 years later. And they went, well, why did I blow all that money on insurance? And the answer was, you got lucky. So
well, you know what, you did it a peace of mind, you know, we've experienced this, right? I mean, you know, you're talking $1,300 a day, you're talking all these you know, these expenses. A very dear friend who's a very loving father and a pet owner, you know, when we got to $6,000 in expenses, you know, we're almost $20,000 beyond that now, but when we got to $6,000 in expenses, you know, he said, literally, you know, you can get another cat. And I looked at him. I didn't say it, but I said, well, thank God this cat chose me and not you. Because, you know, it's a crushing amount of money. And all I can say is, you know, I'm not a better person or more compassionate or more loving than anyone else. All I can say is, and Lily's the same way, if this cat was letting us know that she would fight this and would live, you know, and some of these would manifest in amazing ways, like the doctors coming in and saying, well, we're really worried that she's still very dull. You know, we don't know if she's going to ever get any energy again. And her responding to that by breaking out of her oxygen and immediately climbing up onto Lily's shoulder and staring at the doctor. Well, is that full of life enough for you? You know, maybe these hospitals are not a fun place. Maybe it's the hospital that's dull. Maybe you're dull. But anyway,
maybe you're dull.
And I'm not. And look, this was a great place. I mean, this literally is the best that money can buy. And the and there is an entire team fuzz there, and they love her so much. And she purrs when her doctors come in. In fact, one day they said we're having a trouble checking her lungs in terms of how they sound because we can't hear them over her purring. So so she got great treatment. I don't mean to you know say anything other than that, but you know you're facing this money, but this animal is saying to you, look, I will fight this if you can buy me the time. And when this creature that has chosen me wants to choose life, what's the cost of me ignoring that? I mean, that just feels like the cost is going to be some part of myself, and it's some part of myself I probably need.
Right.
And so... You know, you move forward however you can, and I want to say, you know, Chilpak Nation has been unbelievable. You, Dean Haglund, unbelievable. Paige Branson. Literally, we would not have made it to this point without Paige Branson. So many listeners. I will mention them by name at some point. I want to get on to other topics, but. You know, Chilpak Nation, the Breakfast Club, Team Fuzz continues to grow, and it is really, you know, like the very first donation, we created a GoFundMe, as you know, GoFundMe, yeah. GoFundMe.com/save-fuzz-Aldrin, GoFundMe, Save Fuzz Aldrin. And the very first donation we got, $100 from a member of the Breakfast Club, a wonderful lady, Sandy Hemmerlein, that immediately was able to pay for blood tests that eliminated cancer and immune viruses from the potential diagnosis. How much peace of mind did that buy? Right? That,
yeah,
that amount of peace of mind is priceless. So it... it's an incredible thing, the outpouring. And, you know, one of the hardest things to do when someone you love is sick, right, is maintain the energy you need to keep a positive outlook. I think, you know, any creature, human or otherwise, requires positive energy in order to fight. And it can be so hard to maintain that when you get tired. And, oh, man, you get tired. And people letting you know you're not alone through donations, no matter how size, through sharing their stories and their expressions of love. It means everything.
Hooray.
Dean Haglund, the question was asked, and I wanted to ask about this. You know, we're closing in on some date of having Truth Is Out There 2 finished, and both your Dobermans feature prominently in The Truth Is Out There, not only on camera and in works of art, but when you're talking to Dr. Nicky Monty in that film, she asks you, what would make you sad? And the thing you go to immediately is if something happened to your dogs.
Right.
And
it's still true.
And I know you're Canadian, so which is almost the equivalent of being a really funny Vulcan. But
get that on a T-shirt.
But could you talk a little bit about what these dogs meant to you? Because I realized, man, I don't know if there is any other inspiration in his artwork that was as profound as these dogs. You loved painting them and drawing them. And
absolutely, they're muses, and I still do. You know, I still have a photo collection of them, of pieces of work that I plan to get to. After the grief and the missing and the changing of your entire schedule, and that you're not getting up at 5 to walk them, and there's no evening walk anymore, and all that sort of thing, there is a sense of gratitude at the end of it, of how fantastic it was having those dogs in your life. And so you can sit in the doldrums of depression, of grief, of sadness, but then ultimately the thing that shines through is your memory of them and how great it was. And, you know, so that is the thing that sticks around the longest, it seems. And so I got three canvases with them already sketched on it that I had ready to go when they were still alive. And I still plan to carry on because, you know, they were muses. They were inspirations and they still are. So
I think they're able to be, if I may, because you and Patty, like me and Lily with Fuzz, dedicated to giving them not only the best life you could, but and that's it. Give them the best life you could. I mean, they were incumbent in every decision you made in your lifestyle, in your travel plans,
totally,
in your schedule. And you did everything to make sure that, for example, when a certain diagnosis came down about heart, mm-hmm, that the life quality was so good for this girl. And,
yeah, and absolutely.
I think that's it. I think you probably get to that place where they continue to be muses because you know fundamentally, we all have regrets, obviously. It's hard to silence that voice. But fundamentally, yeah, you know you did right by them, and they continue to be muses. I can't imagine, again, getting back to it, if I were to say, I don't, this amount of money, we got to pull the plug. We got to pull the plug now.
Yeah.
And that cat's not ever going to be a muse for me ever again, because I'm not going to be able to look myself in the mirror while thinking about her.
Well, exactly. Mila had a spinal compression injury. I don't know if you remember that one. A disc had slipped or something while they were fooling around and sort of compressed some of the spinal cord cerebral fluid getting to her hind legs and made her walk funny. And that operation was $8,000. And, you know, we did not regret doing that at all, even though I had heard from other dog owners that, yeah, that happened to their dog and they couldn't justify that payment. But it's all about, you know, exactly.
The animal chooses you. The animal chooses you.
Where the animal chooses you, and yeah, where they sit in your life and how much time and dedication you're putting into it and what they give back to you as well. So
yeah, the relationship. I mean,
relationship.
I mean, there are children, are there not, that are not going to foot the bill to have great care for their parents at a certain time. And that's about
right,
that relationship. And we don't judge that. But you have to honor the relationship you do have. And anyway, Fuzz Aldrin is back. She she got back Thursday night. She has gone walkabout several times today. It's so cute. I mean, I can't let her jump. The will is there to jump. I can't let her. She's so emaciated again. I mean, she was 7.5 pounds soaking wet at her fighting weight. Jeez. And she's lost, you know, she's still not eating solid food, eating through an esophageal tube. So she's really skinny. And so the combination of being really skinny and weak combined with the weight of that tube throwing her off a little bit, she is wandering around like a drunken sailor. It's really stinking cute now that I know that it's not some kind of brain disorder, that it's literally she's learning how to walk right now. And
wow.
Hopefully in the weeks to come, she will be pissing me off by meowing in the background while we're trying to record this very podcast.
Can't wait.
On to some television, as we promised. David Letterman, Netflix. My next guest needs no introduction. Have you had a chance to watch this?
Yeah, I just watched the Barack Obama one.
Yeah, it's coming out monthly. It's coming out monthly, which I think
monthly
is fantastic, because it means that he is going to eschew entirely the drama, the political drama of the day, in favor of going into conversations that have a chance to resonate across time.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that he always had on his TV show, that he felt, you know, he just wanted to linger with a lot of these guests, particularly ones he liked, right? When you think of the Bill Murray and even letting Robin Williams go crazy, there was always this thing of Letterman having no real agenda. He didn't seem to want to listen when they said, we got to go to commercial. I know people who saw it live and the commercials would play in the background, and he would just go, "Don't buy that shit." He would yell over top the commercial. Their own sponsors got big laughs. So it seems that Netflix has afforded him the ability to remove the pressure of corporate sponsorship of a daily TV grind and make it right up his alley, it feels.
Well, and also to let go, after 2 years of retirement, of this idea that he needs to reinvent anything. Like, he was so the guy, right, that reinvented the talk show,
yeah,
that reinvented late night. So that guy. And, you know, there's pressure to continue being that guy. And this show is not a reinvention. What it is a reboot of him. And so, yes, there's a degree to which this first episode, which is really about civil rights and the long struggle towards that in America, and how Barack Obama was a product of that story. There is a degree to which your feelings about Obama will color your feelings about that episode. Hopefully this is the kind of conversation where people who really still to this day have that crazy hatred of him, you know, as the Islamic terrorist who was bringing in Sharia law. How did that work out? You know, hopefully this is the kind of show that would make them realize, oh, wow, this is a nice guy. This is a really nice guy. Because we need that. Oh, my God. You know, on this GoFundMe that we've had, so touched, by the way, when people whose politics I can't stand
right?
come in and drop in a bunch of money because they are so moved by the plight of a cat. And it's like, see, these are the things that matter. And we so easily, right. There are times when I'll read these posts that these friends will make and I go, is this the time I defriend them for this stuff? No, I won't be a person who does that. And then they show up with a donation. You go, see, this is why we should not be doing this. We are stronger when we have a diverse array of people in our lives with diverse views. And hopefully this is the kind of show that will allow those that are always have been and maybe always will be anti-Obama to at least realize maybe a bit of who the man himself actually was. But in terms of Letterman, what was fascinating was how little this seemed at all like a big star trying to stay relevant. There was no moment of that, of Letterman trying to stay relevant. Instead, it really felt like a man looking to redeem all the success he had for all those years by trying to make a positive impact now.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, now that you say that, that's because that was so invisible and because that was not an agenda, you never see what's not on screen. But yeah, that totally could have been a complete vanity play, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't that at all.
It isn't it at all. It's a guy who, like he says at the end, he feels like he's been incredibly lucky and that he hasn't lived up to the luck that he had. And I felt this starting when he did that Nat Geo show, right? Years of Living Dangerously, when he went to India to deal with issues of energy and climate change. And I remember saying to you then that this is kind of the show I wanted to see him get to do, maybe on a monthly basis. And here he is doing it. And it really will be fascinating to see where it goes from here.
Totally.
Okay, Dean, did you see the first episode of the back half of the season of Star Trek Discovery?
I certainly did, and I gotta tap my hat off to you for calling it when I did not see it. In fact, you are absolutely right. You said this thing is going to the mirror universe. And every point that I didn't see, you were correct. And there they are in the mirror universe.
Although like, my theory that Lorca himself was already from there, I think, was refuted. But But yeah, they're in the mirror universe. People seem very happy about this episode. Critics seem happy. happier about this episode. Although, like I said, like we talked about, the critics are liking it more than the audience, seemingly.
Yeah.
Did you like it? Were you happy with it?
I liked elements of it. You know, like you said, how long are we going to sit in this mirror universe? If it's going to be six in there, I don't know if I got the stamina and the wherewithal to run that marathon. That said, there was lots to commend for it. There was a lot of logic to it, I thought, in terms of like how you figure your way out of it, all that sort of stuff. But was there some stub toes again, as we call it with this production? Maybe one or two. You know, I always bounce it off Patty. She hasn't seen it yet because she has no interest in the mirror universe. That just pisses her off because it's sullying the original Star Trek altogether. So I could see that being a thing. So I'm giving it, what, 75%?
Well, that's
on my like a meter.
Pretty much where it's been living, critically, anyway. From what I understand, there were some corrections that give hope. Like you were talking about the logic of it in terms of the storytelling that are possibly really nice signposts for when they get out of the mirror universe. Because, like you said, maybe it's going to be a long marathon if they spend six episodes in there, but they're going to get out at some point. And it seems to me that on display, from what I've heard, were some changes that bode well for, you know, long running, you know, future on the show. Robert Meyer Burnett, who's a very, you know, friend of ours, been on this show, big Trek expert, Trek fan, director of Free Enterprise and of all the bonus features on the Blu-ray releases of Star Trek The Next Generation. He has been quite the huge critic of this show, not alone, obviously, but he thought that this was much more like it. They're starting to get on the beam, as it were. He also, though, was fascinating because he says that the original two-part pilot script written by Brian Fuller and Nicholas Meyer was terrific, was absolutely the Star Trek show we all want. And that when Brian Fuller left, that's when it became the Star Trek show that wanted to be something that everyone would like. And, you know, isn't that it? When you are reaching so hard to try to be something that everyone will like, that's when you're stubbing your toe all over the place.
Absolutely. So is Mr. Burnett saying that this mirror script is the original?
No. But he's saying that this is revealing more of what Brian Fuller's take on
idea
the show
was.
Yeah. It has more
grittier
in keeping with the spirit of the original two-part pilot.
Wow. Okay. I could see that because you see, a lot of the characters seem to be grounding in to probably getting out of their backstory and getting into their present day story, right? Like the security officer now really fully engaged in his post-traumatic stress of being tortured by Klingons and how that's affecting him. We could have started with that. We didn't need to see him getting out of prison in episode 3? Again, I'm saying that the executives were so wowed by the Bible, they've never seen anything so comprehensive that they wanted that on camera before they wanted any of the actual standalone stories that Brian Fuller had. I can imagine.
Now, this has been a year marked by television dealing with concepts of time travel and retconning. Twin Peaks The Return ends up being a show about time travel and retconning. Mr. Robot, which had hinted at it in the previous seasons, overtly reveals that it is a show about an effort to master time travel. And now The X-Files comes back. And I keep thinking about this issue of retconning. because they are retconning their timelines, right? There's been much made about how there's contradictions in terms of the timeline now versus the old show, and which has begged more than one question: is this actually taking place in an alternate universe in some way?
Right.
So there's a lot going on around this. I would like to say, first of all, point out that the X-Files season 11 begins with My Struggle 3. And there could never be a worse title for an episode. There has not been a worse title for an episode of television since My Struggle 2, and before that, since My Struggle 1. But clearly, it's Chris Carter's struggle to figure out what the hell story he wants to tell. And,
right.
Man, people were angry about that first episode again. And I don't think that I think the first episode, My Struggle 3, was a huge improvement over how they launched the season 10. But I understand why people were pissed off, because they were taking their dissatisfaction with that last one, projecting it forward because this wasn't good enough. Other than the fact that it seems like it was directed by someone who directs video games for YouTube Red. I don't even know what if such a thing exists. But I thought it was interesting enough, the season premiere, and I wasn't upset about some of the quote-unquote plot reveals, like, oh, the cancer man is William's father, because we don't know if any of these things are real, right? Let the storytellers have some time, especially in a show that begins with the disclaimer, not that the truth is out there, but that I want to believe, which becomes quickly the words, I want to lie. So
right.
So just look for themes. It would be nice if, to a degree, Chris Carter was given the permission to explore themes at his own rate, the way that David Lynch is, for example, with Twin Peaks. So it seemed like it was open season right away. But then episode 2 comes along. And again, Glenn Morgan, episode called This. You appear in this, and tell me, first of all, how the idea comes about to bring back Langley and bring back Langley in this form.
How does it come about? I get a phone call saying, can you fly to Vancouver? And
Incorrect.
Then they send me a script.
Incorrect. Incorrect.
What happened?
You are on Australian television. You have been forcing Chris Carter to answer one way or another for years. Is the comic book canon? Is the comic book not? First he says it is canon, then he says it isn't. So first he says the gunmen are alive, then he says they aren't. They are dead in this universe. Okay. So on television with him, you say, Chris, then let me throw two words at you, clone gunmen. And that is how this comes about. He reacts audibly at that idea.
Yes.
And, by the way, you've already written a full feature-length script that leads into, listen to me, man, it leads into the simulation.
Oh, I guess so, right?
Yes, with one very minor change, your graphic novel has been written. Yes, it's the backstory that leads into the simulation. All right.
Look at that.
Yes.
I hadn't even put that together.
You
That's
hadn't even
right.
put together the fact that you're the reason that this came about, which is why you're the gunman that's in the simulation and not Byers or Frohickey.
Oh, as opposed to Glenn Morgan saying on that hilarious podcast, it's because I listened to the Ramones and they didn't.
Yeah,
that was funny.
I didn't take a lot of what he had to say so seriously.
Right.
He was taking the piss out of every question, wasn't he? So anyway.
Yes, he said it was. So, well, exactly. I think there's a, not just a retcon, but a future in this virtual world, particularly because of, all of what we're reading in terms of artificial intelligence and whole brain emulation and all of that coming together in what would be the next layer of not just conspiracy, but like the syndicate was, like what finding the truth was, there was always a layer of suppression, oppression, right? That sort of permeated through all the X-Files. And I think that could continue on, right?
Well, that's the amazing thing is I think with this episode, because there were a couple episodes in season 10 that I really liked. One that is absolutely one of the best, and then one that I thought was very good. But the issue isn't about good or bad, I think.
Right.
I think for something like the X-Files that is so legendary, again, it's, is there a reason for it being that is not just love of character or sentimentality? Is there a resonance to it that explains why we need it the way that we did before? And with this episode, bam, there are three reasons that we're hit hard with that all scream relevant, relevant, relevant. First one you just brought up, where this opens this door to these questions of simulations, alternate lives.
Right. Right.
The future.
That we live actually already in
that
an
we
avatar.
Live already, yeah. Yeah.
In a mediated, interconnected internet platform, social media thing, you know.
Another great thing, struggling, probably in 2008 when they did the standalone movie. There's that wonderful moment in I Want to Believe. Isn't that the name of the movie? The 2008 movie? I think it was, right?
Yeah, X-Files,
I Want to Believe.
The future, yeah.
There's that wonderful moment when they return to the FBI building and there Mulder and Scully are waiting and they see the photo of President Bush and Dick Cheney and the X-Files, the old X-Files theme is cued. And it's a wonderful moment because it's this awkward thing of how do these characters fit in a post-9/11 world. And and maybe they don't, which is why we're doing a standalone movie that has nothing to do with conspiracy. And so it is. If you love those characters and if you love having them back and seeing that, you like that movie. And if not, if you wanted it to be part of something larger, you were not going to like that movie. But season 10 did not answer the question. It tried desperately. It reached at an Alex Jones type character. It tried to grab a hold of every conspiracy. It tried to find a way to reboot itself so that it was relevant now, and it didn't succeed. This retconning that's done through My Struggle 3 and Episode 2, brilliant in that they basically say, you know what? Who cares how this ties in with the past syndicate and with the old conspiracies? It's been 20 years. Let them go. You know what is
We've
really scary right now is real world. Let's set it in the real world. Let's set it in an America that's being sold out to foreign interests. Let's set it in an America where all the intelligence agencies are under fire from each other and from the executive branch. It is set today, and it crackles with resonance and relevancy, both dramatically but also thematically.
Right. And then he put in hints, I thought, if I wasn't mistaken, that perhaps then there's a larger simulation going on, that there is not just the simulation that Langley seems to be stuck in, that perhaps the whole episode could be a simulation. There's arguments that he put little visual clues that potentially you look through again.
Okay.
Now, I
think you're talking context, and I don't think you're wrong. More will be revealed. But again, that's why, like, when people complained about, you know, cigarette-smoking man being William's father, you know, you're focusing way too much on context. Give them a chance to develop subtext. So it's not what is happening. It's give them a chance to say, what does it mean that it's happening? Because this is where art resides, right? And let's give them a chance. And that's what's fascinating about this. I agree that that's a possibility contextually, but I think the question itself hints at a subtext which crackles with relevancy number three for me. And it's one example of it, and I'm sure that this is one of the things you're thinking about, but one example of it is, who is that man in the photo with the lone gunman? the iconic photo right. of the lone gunman. Who is that man, right? And in an episode yeah. called This, I love that that man is literally this man. Now, were you familiar with this man, Dean?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
This is a phenomenon born of and for the internet. This man first surfaced in 2009 via the eponymous website thisman.org. It still exists today. The site laid out an enticing premise under a peculiarly worded, all caps headline, "Ever Dream This Man?" In January 2006, in New York, the patient of a well-known psychiatrist drew the face of a man that had been repeatedly appearing in her dreams. And on more than one occasion, that man gave her advice on her private life. And the woman swore she had never met the man in her life, in her real life.
Right.
That portrait was forgotten by the psychiatrist, and it was on his desk, just amidst a bunch of papers, for several days. Until one day, another one of his patients freaks out, recognizing that face, saying, "That man always visits me in my dreams."
Wow.
He also had never seen the man in his waking life. So at that moment, the psychiatrist decides to send the portrait to some of his colleagues that have patients with recurring dreams. Within a few months, four different patients have recognized the man as a frequent presence in their own dream, and all of them all refer to him as, quote, "this man." That's how he appears in their dreams. Hence the title, This. Okay.
Wow. For
the
next one. Okay.
From this and other evidence that accumulated over the years, several theories are proposed. There were hypotheses based on Jungian psychoanalysis, pseudoscience, right. theology, so many conspiracy theories surrounding this man. Dreams from the world over have now been reported, but also sightings in ordinary reality. For example, the "Ever Dream This Man" flyer has been translated into 30 languages and posted around the world. You will find these. It has become a real-life X-File.
Awesome.
Except that it's all bullshit.
Oh.
Even
because?
Because even as thisman.org was attracting its first round of press coverage, online sleuths caught wind of the name to which the website was registered, Andrea Natella, who is an Italian sociologist, marketing strategist, and design fictional artist. Her portfolio contains genuine advertising campaigns and satirical facsimiles of the same. For example, Nutella's responsible for a change.org petition to bring David Bowie back to life.
Nah.
And has a story credit in a comedy about curling. It's a movie that delights in, elbowing people's ribs and exposing emperors without clothes. That's dependent upon an audience that might start out being gullible, but is eventually invited to share in and propagate the joke. And that's exactly what has gone on with the This Man site. It was a joke, but people want to believe so bad that they take a joke that is overtly a joke and they say, "No, but it's real. No, but it's real." The claim that it's a joke is part of the conspiracy, right?
Right.
All right. It spreads like a virus. And there's not enough people who know the truth to be able to spread that truth wide enough to cure the virus and to stop people from getting infected. Truth
right.
is only a temporary cure. Do you see where I'm going with the relevancy of this?
I love it.
Because it makes this man such a perfect symbol for not only the rebooted X-Files, but for an apology of sorts by Chris Carter for the role he right. has played in where we have ended up as a culture, where truth doesn't matter anymore. Everybody has their own facts.
Right.
Right?
Exactly. And even if you know It's a lie you want to perpetrate.
How many times can you respond to the chain email messages on Facebook by linking to the Snopes thing that this is not true? I bought and shared people the Animal 88 story for so long because that made sense to me, that KFC right. was not using real chicken, and it turns out the whole Animal 88 thing was a hoax, and it was exposed years ago. But not enough people knew the truth to tell you, to prevent you from telling me, to prevent me from infecting other people. So KFC, I'm sorry. I think both the Cancer Man's retconning and the twist of William and this man and so much of where we're going, which ties in explicitly to this White House, to this point in time where foreign governments and entities are able to manipulate our faith in our institutions and our affection for each other, drive wedges mm-hmm. between our affection for each other by continuing to take advantage of the virus of disinformation. And I think this show in no small part is an attempt at both an apology and a correction. And that is why I Want to Believe automatically becomes I Want to Lie. If you want to believe in something, it means you want to lie about that thing, as opposed to I Want to Know. The truth is out there, and I want to know what that truth is.
Wow. Boy, that's a production meeting at the old X-1013 office that I'm sure went around the round table. Because that's exactly it. You know, even I feel a bout of guilt in my role in getting us to this part of the society where a conspiracy theorist now is the most powerful man in the world, and how troubling that is.
We'll talk about this. We'll talk about each episode a little bit more each week as they come. We're at the end of this episode. I wanted to end with a final message, a tweet question that was sent to us. And I'm so sorry I did not copy down the name of the woman that tweeted this question at us. So my apology. I will do better next week.
okay.
But she begins by saying, Dean, you rocked it. And indeed, I have
Yay.
Not brought up your performance. So much fun. Such a great job on that speech. And I don't know what
you
connected with about the New England Patriots, because you don't give a rat's ass about football. But oh my God, the joy that you embodied in that. I don't know what you connected with, but it was real. It was palpable. And by the way, it's another dig at the president, because of course, President Trump loves nothing more than the New England Patriots. Tom Brady's his favorite athlete.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
And he's the that's the organization that he keeps holding up as a counterexample for all the other sons of bitches who protest things like black people being killed at the hands of police officers. So he loves him, his New England Patriots. Anyway,
I had no idea.
The question was, Dean, you rocked it. Do you appear in any other season? 11 episodes. I noticed you are still alive.
Right.
So what's the answer?
Yeah. Well, I think the answer is, unless they edit me from the outtakes of my one day on set, the answer is no, because they've filmed them all. They're all wrapped up and in the can and ready to air. So
could
sadly,
be outtakes. I also I would imagine there could be flashbacks, so you might in that way, right? They might call back to it.
Yeah.
I was more interested in not would you appear, but would we hear you? That actually...
That could be a thing.
So,
yeah, coming through the phone again.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, my contract was said for your work on the X-Files, not specifically this one episode, so... they could do that.
We'll see. They could also call you in to do some voiceover stuff.
Yes, I've done that from down under, so that's not a hard one. In fact, I could have filmed that whole thing down here, but, you know, and then I wouldn't have got to hang out with Glenn and all the gang.
Exactly. And God knows you've done enough phoning in your performances in your life. You don't. Did you hear me? I said phoning in your performances. All right. That brings us to an end of another exciting installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We will continue to revisit David Letterman, Star Trek Discovery, and each episode of The X-Files in the weeks to come and the months to come. You can find every episode we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com.
Yay! You can listen to us, or you can write us, like so many people have done. You can write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Can they like us on Facebook, Dean?
Oh, please do. It's always fun to like us. We're at Facebook.com, Chill Pack Hollywood. And where are we on iTunes these days?
I don't know. People can subscribe by our website, Chill Pack Hollywood, to iTunes and to Blog Talk Radio and Stitcher and all those other good things. All right. We've gone way over time. Until next week, I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness.
And I'm Dean Haglund. Take care, Fuzz.
Belated spoiler alert.